Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Luke.
Glory to you, Lord Christ.
Now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going out to encounter another king in war, will not sit down first and deliberate whether he is able, with 10,000, to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise be to you.
Good morning, friends, and welcome again to All Saints on this Labor Day weekend. And I know that especially on this weekend, there really are a million places that you could be, a million things that you could be doing, but you're here with us this morning. We're glad for that. But you'll know that throughout the summer, we've been looking at Jesus' parables. We've been looking at these stories that he puts before us again and again to gently and subtly remind us of who he is, who God is, and what God's kingdom looks like in our world. And this morning, we come to our last set of parables. And they're a rather strange and less well-known cluster of parables, but I think that they're good ones to end on. They're good ones to end on because they talk not only about hearing Jesus, but also following Jesus. Well, I've been at All Saints for a little over 2 years now, and I've yet to use a Lord of the Rings illustration in any of my sermons. So I feel like I deserve this, all right? Here we go. In the very beginning of Lord of the Rings, you'll remember that Frodo is leaving his home in Hobbiton behind. He's beginning a long journey that Gandalf is sending him on, a journey that he does not yet fully understand. And as they're leaving home behind, here's what Tolkien writes. It says, "They made for the green hill country, and as they began to climb its first slopes, they looked back and saw the lamps in Hobbiton far off twinkling in the gentle valley. And when the light of the last farm was far behind, peeping among the trees, Frodo turned, and he waved a hand in farewell and said, 'I wonder if I shall ever look down into that valley again.' And a few pages later, he says to his friend something that his Uncle Bilbo used to say to him, and that is, 'It's a dangerous business, Frodo, going out your door. You step out into the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to.'" Friends, this morning we're going to see that following Jesus is something like this. It's a journey. And it's a journey that is more dangerous and more perilous than we will ever understand. What I want us to see is that discipleship, in other words, following Jesus, is a journey through costliness and towards saltiness. See, they rhyme. Costliness, saltiness, those are our 2 points this morning. Costliness and saltiness, first costliness. Well, turning to our text, we see over and over again the repetition of this phrase, "cannot be my disciple." Disciple. It's this word that Christians love to use. So before we continue, it really is important to pause and ask what it means. Well, the Greek word that is used by Jesus for disciple here means literally learner or student. But when we hear learner or student, we can't just think an academic classroom, intellectual setting, because discipleship was much more active than that. Because we're told that in Jesus' day, a disciple of a Jewish rabbi would actively follow that rabbi everywhere. He'd follow him to the temple. He'd follow him into his home. He would follow him into his dinner table. Think of a younger sibling copying literally everything their older siblings do. That's a disciple. Discipleship was hanging on every word and every action of the rabbi. Discipleship was this kind of walking and talking and walking and listening. And that's what's happening in our passage. Large crowds are following Jesus as he walks. Jesus, we see, has become a popular teacher. And there are many would-be disciples who are interested in walking with him and following him. And what Jesus does in our passage is he looks at them and he says, if you want to go any further, you need to know what you're in for. That's why he tells the two parables he does. In verses 28 through 32, first we see the tower parable. Which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, he will be mocked for not being able to finish the job. And then in verse 31, he tells the war parable. He says, or what king, going out to encounter another king in war, will not first sit down and deliberate whether he is able to win the war? Otherwise, he begs for peace. What we see here is that in both parables, someone is making plans. One man is planning to build a tower, and the other man is planning to go to war. And in both situations, there's very real danger and risk involved. The tower builder, he risks failure and mockery, and the king, he faces defeat and loss. What both parables are emphasizing for us is the importance of counting the cost before beginning. Counting the cost before beginning, not just a business endeavor or a war endeavor, but spiritual endeavors before setting out. Jesus is saying, look, I'm glad that all of you are here, but before following me, you need to know what it's going to cost you. So by way of application, the first thing Jesus is inviting us to do this morning is to stop. He's inviting us to sit down and to deliberate and consider the cost of Christianity. Now, maybe some of you are here this morning and you're thinking about becoming a Christian. What I hope you hear is that Christianity is not easy. It's not easy. And yet in our culture today, so much for what passes as Christianity is not actually the real thing. I read a story the other day of a man whose young children were exposed to measles, and their family doctor suggested that the kids get a shot in order to protect them. And the doctor said to the family, they said, this shot, it will give your children a light case of the measles, so mild that no one will be able to detect it, but enough so that they will not contract the real thing. And this feels a lot like what has happened inside the church. We've been vaccinated or inoculated from the real thing. We've gotten this little shot. This little shot that protects us. We've gotten a little bit of religion, a religion created to meet all of our individual needs and desires and aspirations. But it's a religion that does not ask us anything. It doesn't ask anything from us. It doesn't cost us anything. Maybe some of you, others of you like me, have been a Christian most of your life. It's still good for us, too, in this moment, this morning, to sit down, to look at where we've been, to look at where we're going, and ask whether our faith has cost us anything. Saying this passage, I know that I was convicted that really and truly, I've lived most of my life with one of my primary aims to just be to avoid suffering. To avoid suffering, avoid pain, discomfort, displeasure. But friends, that is Buddhism, and it is not Christianity. Younger folks here today, kids, teenagers, college students, it's important for you to know that at some point, following Jesus will cost you something. Maybe it hasn't really cost you anything yet, but at some point, it will. It'll cost you an invitation to a party. It'll cost you an invitation into a friend group or into a fraternity or sorority. It'll cost you a job. It'll cost you a promotion. It'll cost you something. And speaking of costs, for a whole week now, all the talk in the sports world has been about one man. And that man is named Andrew Luck. Andrew Luck, quarterback of the Indianapolis Colts, two-time Pro Bowler, who announced last week that he was retiring from the NFL at the ripe age of 29. Some people applauded his decision, saying Andrew did what was best for him and therefore was good. Other people ridiculed and even booed his decision. One commentator called his decision, quote, the most millennial thing ever. No matter your opinion of Luck, What no one can debate is that his decision was costly. By retiring now, at age 29, in the prime of his career, Luck is leaving approximately $450 million on the table. It's a lot of money. So retirement cost Andrew Luck $450 million. What does following Jesus cost us? Turning back to our text, we see that the first thing that following Jesus might cost us is relationships. Look at verse 25, relationships. If anyone comes to me and doesn't hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, he cannot be my disciple. Now, if these words sound harsh to us, it's important for us to understand that they would have sounded even harsher to someone in the first century, because today we live in this hyper-individualized age where people leave home and family all the time. I grew up in Memphis, and now I live in Austin. But in that day, no one left home and family behind, because family was a real and true identity marker. It was perhaps the truest thing outside of being Jewish about you. But for us, of the relationships that Jesus mentions here, perhaps the most difficult for us to consider are wife and children. Wife, because in our world, romantic love is truly everything. I've quoted for you before the Belgian marriage therapist, Esther Perel, who says that in our world today, we still want from our partners everything that we've always wanted: companionship, economic support, social status, children. But now today, on top of all of that, I also want you to be my best friend. I want you to be my trusted confidant and my passionate lover. I want you to be my intellectual equal and the best parent. I want one person to give me what once an entire village used to provide. One person for everything. That's our model. For others of us, our one person for everything may not be a spouse or a lover, a partner, but it might be our children. Our children so easily become our identity and our deepest loyalty, the truest thing about us, the center around which all of our lives gravitate. And many of you, if you're parents, you feel this way today as school starts back and suddenly extracurriculars and homework and sports start back. It is so easy for that again to be the gravitational pull of our lives. But whether it's spouse, girlfriend, boyfriend, mother, father, child, or the prospects of having any of these things, Jesus says, you must hate them. Now, don't misunderstand him. Jesus and the Bible have a higher view of relationships and marriage and parenting than you or I will ever possess. But he is saying, relative to your love for me, all of your other relationships, that love should look like hate. So relationships. But then he tells us that discipleship might not just mean a reorientation of our relationships. It also will probably mean suffering. We see this in verse 26. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Jesus is saying, if you want to follow me, you will suffer. You will suffer. Like a man on his way to be crucified, at some point you will be stripped bare of something that you love. And friends, this is a terrifying prospect, but it also might be liberating for us when we consider the surpassing worth of knowing Christ that Paul talks about. And then in verse 33, we see Jesus highlighting not relationships, not suffering, but material possessions. He says, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. And here Jesus is talking about stuff. He's talking about stuff. He's talking about all of our wealth and our capital and all the things we've accumulated over the years. And he's saying, renounce it. In the Greek, this word for renounce is apotasso. Apotasso. Some people translate it, bid it farewell, kiss it goodbye, leave it behind. Again, it's a journey. And if you want to follow Jesus, Jesus is saying you do have to travel light. So think about your own life and ask, what do I need to leave behind? St. Ignatius in the 15th century, he talked about attachments. Attachments. He said we all have attachments. We all have these things which overly preoccupy us and keep us from hearing God, and maybe even from hearing hard passages like this. So what are your attachments? What are my attachments? Because we all have them. We all have these things which we must leave behind. And that's because in a world plagued by sin, sin is a parasite. Sin is a parasite. It attaches. It's like the zebra mussels, right, which have attached themselves and all the docks and the boats and all the rivers and lakes all around Texas. A parasite, what does it do? It attaches itself to a good thing, but then it sucks it dry. So we all have attachments. We all have parasites in our lives. What do we need to detach? What do we need to leave behind in order to journey with God? But as you consider these things, as you consider these hard things, I do want you to hear the good news of the gospel, friends. And that is that Jesus has already gone on his own journey. Before you begin any thoughts of going on your costly journey, know that Christ has already been on one of his own. Friends, Jesus is the one who left behind the glories and riches of heaven, the glories and riches of his eternal relationship with his Father. He's the one that came to our earth and entered our broken world. And here in Luke 14, even now, he is on a journey up to Jerusalem, where he will leave behind his very life for you and for me. Friends, Christ is the one, he is the king who sat down and counted the cost of going to war against the king of sin and darkness in our world, and he decided he was worth it, even if it meant death. And friends, that is also why, if you've come to know Jesus as the great lover of your soul, everything that is true of Jesus is now true of you. Because you have been united to him, everything that is true of him is true of you. And you, too, have left behind the guilt of sin and the prospect of death. And it's why one morning when you were baptized, you stood up here or your parents stood up here, and the first question that a pastor here asked you was, do you renounce Satan and all his works? And you said, I renounce them. I'm leaving one world behind in order to enter another world. So we renounce, we apotasso, we leave behind whatever it costs. So discipleship is a journey. It's a journey through costliness. But friends, why do Christians give up things? Why do we renounce? Why do we apotasso? We don't just embrace cost for cost's sake. We don't just do hard things or give things up in order to earn our salvation or because it's fashionable, but we do so in order that we might become salty. With that, let's turn to point two, saltiness. Well, picking back up our text in verse 34, you'll notice that Jesus puts yet another image before us, this time the image of salt. He says, salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? Is of no use, either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. These are strange verses. What's going on? Well, in order to understand these verses, we need to understand, first of all, how salt was used in Jesus' day, and then second of all, what it meant in that time for salt to lose its saltiness. Commentators tell us that the way we think about salt today is different from the way people thought about salt in the first century. Why? Because when we think about salt, we think about table salt, right? We think about salt for food. But in Jesus' day, the primary use of salt was not for food, but for farming. Salt could be used agriculturally both as a fertilizer and also as a preservative. As a fertilizer, salt could wilt weeds on the surface of the ground, but then it could seep down into the ground and improve the soil beneath the ground. And then as a preservative, salt was often mixed into manure, into dung hills, in order to keep the dung hills from rotting. And then this manure, these dung hills, of course, could then be used and spread as fertilizers as well. And so we understand this. Verse 35 begins to make more sense. It's of no use either for fertilizing the soil or for preserving manure. What about salt losing its saltiness? Well, commentators again tell us salts in the first century contained a very small amount of something called gypsum. And over time, salt could disintegrate and it could lose some of this gypsum. And when salt lost its gypsum, it lost its saltiness. It could no longer fertilize. It could no longer give life. It could no longer give growth in the same way. And friends, you see now how this image of salt is directly related to the earlier parables, directly related to the tower and the war. See, in the same way that a half-built tower is useless, and in the same way that it is useless to enter a war you cannot win, so is salt without saltiness. It's useless. cannot do its job. It cannot fertilize. So what we see again is the purpose of our discipleship, the purpose of our renouncing, our giving up, our apotasso, our bidding farewell. Friends, it is not to earn God's love or his favor. You already have it. Nor is it some old and medieval asceticism, nor is it some modern and trendy giving things up and doing hard things for its own sake. No, it is for the life of the world. It's so we may be salty, it's so we may fertilize and give life. And what this means for you and for me is that we need to ask ourselves a few questions. The first question we need to ask ourselves are we salty? Are we salty? See, in order for the church to be salty, we have to be and look different from the world. In the same way that salt is not the same thing as soil or weeds or manure, we as a church must look different and even strange to the eyes of the world. And that means that we need to think long and hard about our lives. We need to sit down and we need to ask whether certain areas of our life have become indistinguishable from the lives of the world. That's one of the reasons I'm teaching a Sunday school class on technology this fall, because technology is such a pervasive part of our world. It's the air that we breathe, it's the water we swim in, and rarely do we take a step back and ask whether our tech lives, our tech habits, the way we use technology is good and true and wise. And in that class, every individual and every family will come up with different answers to this question. They will figure out what is best for themselves and their families with technology. But again, it's important to take a step back. And it's important to do so not only in the area of tech, but in every area of our lives. Our romantic lives, our work lives, all of it. See, in order to become a winsome and attractive, compelling witness in our world, we must ask, am I set apart? Am I different in any way? Am I salty? And regardless of how you answer this question, all of us can grow. All of us can grow. All of us can become saltier. And that leads to our second question we need to ask ourselves. And that is, how do I become saltier? How do I restore my saltiness? Well, here's how it happens. Step one, it starts by recognizing that Jesus is the great salt of the earth. He is the one who fertilizes and gives life and gives growth. It is ultimately not us. It's like Fleming Rutledge always says, God is the subject of the verb. In every sentence, God comes first and the verb follows. Every good thing comes from him, saltiness included. But then step two, we must take a step back and see that our habits, in other words, the way that we spend our days and our hours and our lives, really do matter and really do impact our saltiness. We've mentioned for you before, Justin Early, who wrote this new book called The Common Rule, Habits of Purpose for an Age of Distraction. And I would highly commend this book to you. Justin Early, who is he? Well, he's a high-powered lawyer in Virginia who became so burned out a number of years ago by the rapid pace of that world that eventually he had a breakdown. In his own words, his life cratered. He didn't sleep for 48 straight hours. He went to the doctor and they prescribed him sleeping pills. One night his wife asked him to put away the dishes and he grabbed a plate and then had to ask his wife, where does this go? Because he had become so confused and so disoriented, he didn't even know where the dishes went anymore. See, Early had gone into his law firm in part to be salt and be fertilizer and be a missionary. But in time, he says, the missionary was the one that was converted. The missionary was the one that was converted. Early uses the metaphor of a house. He says, my house, it was decorated with Christian trimmings and content, but the architecture of the house was built just the same as everyone else's. He was logging the same hours. He was relying on all the same notifications and technologies and busy schedules. And this may be true of some of you. You're a Christian. And God has you, and he is never letting you go. You cannot lose your salvation, but you can lose your saltiness. As Early says, your mission might stand for one thing, but your habits might stand for something entirely different. And usually your habits win. This happens all the time. I would see when I was working with college students at UVA, people would come to me and they would say, they'd be fired up and excited because they were going to join a fraternity or sorority with maybe a couple of Christian friends, and they were going to change that fraternity and change that sorority. But you know what happened? 9, 12, 15 months later, the fraternity had changed them. Friends, the reality is we need habits and rhythms of life that will protect us from losing our saltiness. Again, not our salvation, but our saltiness. So sit down and pray and ask God, what is one habit that you might weave more and more into your life in order to restore your saltiness? For some of you, it might be prayer. Early talks about prayer before phone. That's one of his rules, prayer before phone. Because if you're like him and you're like me, what's the first thing you do every morning? You wake up, you go to the phone, you scroll and you scroll and you scroll and you catch up on sports and you catch up on politics and you catch up on Instagram and Facebook. But what if you started the day not with scrolling, but with praying? With kneeling before God, maybe even one or two sentences, starting your day in God's love and not the rat race of our world. And many mornings, we're not going to feel like praying, right? We're not going to feel like praying, but we do it. And in time, we pray our prayers until our prayers pray us. Others of you, it could be worth looking at the 10 spiritual practices that All Saints has laid out on our website. And one of them that you might find rather strange, particularly in our world today, is fasting and moderation. See, people today, we give up things. We give up gluten, or we give up sugar, we give up alcohol, and we like to tell people about those things on our social media feeds. But what if we gave things up, not for our media feeds, but in order to more and more hunger and thirst after God? What if we did so that we might be saltier? So, question one, am I salty? Question two, if I've lost my saltiness, it's okay. God still loves me. How do I restore it? Question three, then, is where can I go and be salty? Where can I go and be salty? Anthony Bradley is a professor and theologian in New York, and he says that once we understand that Jesus is calling us to be fertilizer, our job as a church becomes very clear, and it's simply this. It is to go where things are messy and to go where nothing grows. It is to go where things are messy, the manure pile, and to go where nothing grows, arid and barren and lifeless soil. See, Bradley tells us we cannot spend all our time in places that are already nice and already shiny, already clean, and already thriving, but we must go to places that are messy. We must go to places where nothing grows. So friends, look around you. Look at your own life, look at your family, look at your neighborhoods, your communities, and ask, where does nothing grow here? Where is it lifeless? And then go into those places. And what you'll find is when you go into those places, God is already there. God is already there working. And then you get the great opportunity to join him in all the work he's already doing. College students, many of you are here with us this morning. Some of you are even from Auburn. We welcome you. College students, the college campus, talk about a place where nothing grows today. A place filled with addictions, a place filled with misplaced hopes and idols. College students, go into those places, knowing that God loves you, and be salt there. High schools, again, high schools, places of loneliness, places of isolation and pressure, anxiety about the future. High school students, go into your schools. Go into the places that are barren and lifeless and be fertilizer in those places. Men and women, go into your workplaces. Go into your school boards and your PTAs and be fertilizer and be salt. So to recap, discipleship is a journey. It's a journey that leads through costliness and towards saltiness. It's a journey in which we give up and detach from the things of the world so that we might become the life of the world. It's Genesis 12 pattern. It's a Genesis 12 pattern that we see with Abraham. He leaves things behind so that he might be a blessing to the world. So friends, here we are. It's Labor Day weekend. The summer is over. We're heading into the fall, and everyone is making plans. And my encouragement to you is to give at least as much thought to your spiritual life and your spiritual endeavors and your spiritual plans as you are to your family plans and your business plans and your financial plans and everything else. Because the cost is high. So count the cost. But as you do so, know that what's even greater than the cost is the result. What's even greater than the means is the end. And that's a fertilized world. A fertilized world. A world where everything grows. A new world that God will usher in one day in which there's no longer any place, anything, or anyone that is barren and lifeless. May God bring that world soon. Amen.